Today is Friday, April 14th, 2023. This is part 8 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charlie Schulz. Charlie spells his last name S-C-H-U-L-Z. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Charlie. How are you today?
Good afternoon, Tom. I'm just fine. Thank you.
Good. Charlie, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you do have my permission.
Thank you very much. We left off completing some adventures you had in 1988. Could you please take us into 1989?
Okay. In 1989, April 9th, I joined CL and Frank Barrios, and we drove out to Toro Weep. And that was my first time out there. And the next day, took the trail from Toro Weep down to Lava Falls and to the rapids down there, and hung out there for quite a while, watching some rafts go through, and even saw a couple of kayaks go through.
Oh, wow.
And, it was kind of interesting because the kayaks were some of the younger people, and one of them, we walked down to talk to him when he got done. He said, "I can't believe I did this. Oh, this is amazing. This is wonderful." Anyway, he was quite happy with himself, but he was also in tears because he had survived.
Oh, my.
And, it was really quite an event. We saw a couple of motorboats go through, and we saw then a group of four or five oar-powered rafts. Everybody made it through okay.
Uh-huh.
But I've been there a couple other times, of course, on raft trips, and it's always something to watch as the various ones go through there.
Nice. Did you get a chance to interface with the ranger there?
No.
Okay.
There wasn't to my knowledge, there wasn't a ranger out there at that time.
Okay. All right.
There was a guy that got upset with us because we had parked and set up our camp, and for a little while we had one of the radio in one of the cars, not loud, but anyway, he was playing a little bit of music, and he came over and he was all upset because we were interrupting his silent sojourn.
Oh.
On the rim, so,
uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I understood that, and
yeah.
We did quiet down, but he was in a real huff when he went off. I can remember that.
Okay.
And but the most telling part of that was coming back up that trail.
I was just going to ask you, what do you remember about that trail?
Oh, that was the hardest trail I've ever hiked out of the canyon, and I think it was hot, and that black rock was giving off a lot of heat, and you climb like, I think it's like 3,000 feet and a mile and a half or something like that. And I seriously sat down a couple of times and just thought, this is severe.
Hmm.
I don't think I've ever climbed anything or, and I've been on mountains and a bunch of other stuff that at much higher altitudes, it was as tough as that walk from the river back up to Toro Weep on that trail. And even some of the times, you know, going up, you could kind of see because people had marked the rocks where to go. Going down was a little harder. But even at that, even with the trail kind of marked on the way up, it was hard sometimes to even figure out where to go next. But that was one thing it stuck in my memory ever since that was how hard that was coming up out of there.
Yeah. Yep, on a nice spring day, nice direct sunshine. Yeah.
Yeah, and we, you know, we went down, and, you know, you get down pretty quick, and I think we must have hung around down there 2 or 3 hours just watching the boats and stuff. We just hit it right, and, well, then, you know, it's noon or 1 o'clock, and you're starting back up, so you're not coming up in the coolest time of the day. So, in any case, it was one of the, and we weren't carrying any pack. We were just, you know, a couple water bottles.
Just a day hike.
Yeah.
But y'all three made it.
Pardon?
You all three made it.
We all made it back up. And the next day, we went over to Indian Hollow, or went down Indian Hollow, and went down to Ghost Rock.
Okay.
Where the big figures are. And I don't know if I was still delirious from the day before or what, but I remember we went down there, and I wrote it up in my log. And I've got a picture of us there, but I cannot remember much about that other than that's where we went, and that's what we went down there to see.
Okay.
And then from that, we went on back. We only hung out there another day, and then and went back. So that was like the 13th or 14th. It would be 14th, I think, when we head back.
Okay.
And then the next time the canyon was October 7th to do another rim-to-rim.
Was this an organized event that you put together?
Yep.
Okay.
And I was trying to see, probably had about 89 was one of the bigger groups, so it was probably about 30 people.
Oh, wow.
And
again, friends of friends and friends, yep. Workmates, their yep. Work, their friends. Okay.
Yeah.
Two buses?
Pardon? We just did large and got to a larger bus.
Oh, okay.
We ended up with a bus that's like, would hold like 60 people. Had a bathroom, you know, those kind of buses.
Wow, okay. So Greyhound kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't have a budget for that year. But one of the other years I had a budget for later, we were paying about close to $2,000 for the bus and the driver.
Okay.
So that was kind of typical at that time. And usually we tip the driver as well another couple hundred dollars. So
okay.
That was kind of the cost of the bus at that time. So we were running with a budget then of about $5,000, between $5,000 and $6,000. And I had some help from Park, Potom, and as far as kind of, we had a pizza party the night before we left. At generally, that was at his house. And then we gathered at the place where I used to work, or I worked around until I retired, which became AG Communication Systems on the north side of Phoenix.
Okay.
And the bus would pick us up there, and then we would leave from there.
Where did you have the pizza party? At whose house?
Park Hotem, H-A-U-T-E-M. His first name is spelled Park, P-A-R-K-E. And he and his wife, Kay. Park was, I don't know if you remember, but back in the... When I first started running, there was one guy that got me into it, and then I got into this group from Moon Valley, which is a little neighborhood in North Phoenix. And Park was the one I was working with him at that time, and he brought me into that group that was running on the canal in North Phoenix that were out of Moon Valley.
Okay.
And so he and I had continued to work together for several years, and then he went to... Eventually, he went to Venezuela and
oh, wow.
Worked down there for a while for GTE before he came back and retired. So, but that was after we stopped running Grand Canyon. So
okay.
We were running weekends together and, you know, sometimes during the week even on occasion. But most of the time on the weekends or holidays or special runs if we do a 10K or something like that. But that kind of went by the way as we started running more and more trails and not very many organized races.
So was Park helping you kind of organize and put this together, or was anybody else helping you at all?
Well, Park was probably, well, I mean, when I look back on it, Park was really the only other one that would help or helped organize, and that was to host the pizza party the night before, and so we would order whatever, you know, 10 pizzas or 15 pizzas, because
okay.
These guys eat a lot of pizza.
Ah.
And beer, and it would be at his place. Now, he moved a couple times, and then one time, at that time, I was no longer married, and I had a house in Phoenix that we used a couple times as well for the pizza party.
Okay.
And we always had to get together as these got bigger on Thursday night, just to make sure everybody was there, everybody knew what to do the next day, and to check out some of the newbies and make sure we hadn't recruited somebody or somebody got recruited that had no idea what he was getting into.
Okay.
And talk about, you know, tell lies and stories about last year and all that kind of stuff. And then on Friday morning to gather together and then start to drive up to Flagstaff. We had one person who didn't, he was from Palm Springs, California.
Okay.
And he didn't like coming early. He had too many things to go on, and he was quite a character, so we put up with his privilege, if you will. But Ted Martinez, and he would fly from Palm Springs to Phoenix, and then from Phoenix to Flagstaff on Friday. And then we would wait for him at the airport in Flag and pick him up and then go eat in Flagstaff and then do the drive up to the North Rim from there. And that worked fine except for 1 year. And for some reason, Ted stuck a pistol in his carry-on bag.
Oops.
And he never got out of Palm Springs. So he did catch up with us, but he had to rent a car and he drove it all the way up. And then somebody volunteered to drive it around
for him.
So he could get it back. But But Ted hung in there with us for right up until the end. He passed away in like 2016 or 2017. He was quite a character.
All right.
Yeah, he was 54 in 1991, so 60s. And he was pretty close to 80 then, I would guess, late 70s.
So you'd pick up Ted at the airport, and then bus driver would head off to the North Rim.
We'd eat in Flagstaff first, and then we'd head off to the North Rim.
Right, and you had lodging over there.
Right.
So you would arrive kind of late, maybe 10 o'clock or so?
No, from Flag to the North Rim is 200 miles or so, and the bus drivers that we got were always wanted to get us there by dinner time for 6 o'clock.
Oh, okay.
So we usually got there, and I would get the keys to the room, and we had reservations, so they'd all head to the dining room, and then I'd pass out keys, and we just used those little frontier cabins.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they had two beds in each one of them, and they also had connecting doors, so sometimes those were opened up depending who's on the other side.
Right, right.
And, then the next morning, I'm not a coffee drinker, so I was never very sympathetic to them, but the ones that drank coffee would wander down to the little snack thing down there because it was open first thing in the morning, like 5 or 5:30.
Right.
And they would get coffee, and then the bus would pull around right about 6 o'clock. And I told everybody that the bus is leaving no later than 6:15.
Hmm.
And so they would all have their luggage out and everything and load up the bus, and we would head to the trailhead, and there at the trailhead he would open up the door, everybody kind of pile off, and I've got a couple of pictures of some of the groups. We didn't take pictures every year standing at the trailhead, you know, and they're in those days short shorts and t-shirts and sometimes a fanny pack or a water bottle or two, and you're all in the cheering and off down the hill and start on across.
So this was not, help me out, because I'm thinking people like to time how fast they go from one side to the other.
Yeah.
How would you do that? How would you keep track of people's time?
We did, you did it on your own. We never, it was kind of hard to fake it for one thing, because everybody knew what time you left.
Right.
And so when you got to the other side, we all at that time carried a wristwatch or something that we could time ourselves.
Right.
And when you came out, you just push a button and somebody was there. Usually we recruited a person, I shouldn't say usually, just about always. I don't think, except for maybe the first time, we always had a person beside the driver who was a non-runner, who was willing to be at the trailhead when we came out and record the times, and even later on had a camera and would tape interviews. And I sent some of those CDs along to the person you asked me to send the running stuff to.
Oh, great.
So see some of those CDs. And how was your run, and what'd you think of the canyon, and have you done this before? And sometimes it was even when they were getting on the bus or getting off the bus, there was one occasion where the guy would stand there and the people are giving the name and saying three times or first time or, you know, six times or whatever that they've done it as they're getting off the bus. Hmm. And then there was always the ones that, you know, I'm never doing this again, or nobody told me it was this bad, or, you know, things like that. So you got a full range. And that was generally at the trailhead. And like I said, I think the other day, I was always surprised we never got in trouble. Nobody ever from the Park Service or anybody else ever came around that trailhead when we were there. And we carried a cooler up there and set it by, there was a sign there that talked about the trail down and stuff. And we had at least one, and I think on occasion probably two coolers of beer just sitting over on the other side of that. And again, nobody ever bothered us. But
right.
And we hung out there as people came out. So if somebody came out and the first person out, whatever, said, you know, I was 5 hours and 10 minutes. Well, if the next guy coming out couldn't say, I'm 5 hours and 2 minutes.
Right.
Because you all started at the same time. So it was an honor system, but
yeah.
I don't
okay.
think we ever had a problem with anybody finagling any more than maybe a minute or two, if
yeah.
at all. It was just when you came out. Now, there were a few didn't carry watch, so they'd come out and say, what time is it?
Right.
And you'd say, they say, what time we start? You say, well, 6:20. Says, okay, well, that figures out to be 5 hours and 35 minutes. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we took.
That makes sense. And again, you're kind of flying under the radar screen of the Park Service here. You're not advertising anywhere where somebody would send a, you know, cut the advertisement out, send it to the park and say, hey, do you condone this? And so, you know, park people are busy. If nobody noticed, nobody would notice. And, you know, why would they want to do anything? Unless, of course, you had a lot of walking wounded, and in which case, then that wouldn't go so well.
Right, or if we had to have somebody rescued, that probably would have
yeah.
been the end of everything. Yep.
Yeah, but so long as everything's going okay and it's no big, not advertising, and you're not, you know, holding an event in quotes. Yeah. And everybody enjoyed that run that time, 1989, all 30 folks
yeah.
there?
You know, I'm looking at the times. 434 was... Yeah, the two that I told you went back and forth for a few years. Dick Lane, who was 61, and Terry Moore, who was 45. One was 434. That was Dick, the older one. And 444 for Terry. But the year before, it had been, or 2 years before, it had been the other way around. Dick Lane was 503, and Terry was 444. So,
what's Terry's last name?
Terry Moore, M-O-O-R-E.
Thanks. Okay. And Dick was 61?
61.
Okay. And Terry was?
45.
45. Okay. Good for them.
Yeah, no, Dick continued to run after we didn't do the canyon anymore. We had kind of a reunion 1 year, and I'll have to look and see what year that was. We didn't do a run, but we went to the Grand Canyon and just goofed off and hung out for a couple of days on the South Rim and drank a lot of beer and, again, told lies and all that kind of stuff, like 2000 or something. And Dick Lane came to that as well, but it was a pretty small group. I think we only had like 10 or 15 people for that. But he was still, at that time, he would have been pretty close to 70.
Yeah.
And he... still doing some ultras, at least 50 milers, stuff
wow.
like that. So he was another one that didn't start until he was like 50 years old. And he had gone to his wife had complained that he was too fat and he needed to lose some weight. And he went to the doctor, and the doctor told him he needed to lose some weight. And so he decided he would start running, and that's what he did.
Wow.
And he just kept running and running and running. So
that's lovely.
Yeah.
Really nice. What was your time that year, 89?
Let's see. That was 89 was my fastest time, 5:37.
Okay. Congrats. And who was the slowest that day?
And the slowest one that day, a guy by the name of Larry Brown. He was 8:46.
Okay.
And he was 41 years old. He was a friend of one of the people that we knew from work. And he knew what he was getting into. It wasn't anything that he didn't know. But he when he left, he said, "I'm just walking." And that's what he did. He just walked across.
It's not a bad time for walking.
No, not at all.
Yep. And you got to hang out for 3 hours on the rim waiting for him to show up, so that was all right?
Right, yep. And most of the people did hang out because it was still, if we left at 6:30 and you did 6, it was still 12:30, and we usually couldn't check into the rooms until 2:30, 3 o'clock or something like that. So there was really nothing else to do except hang out at the trailhead. You couldn't go get a shower. Well, you could have gone to the campground and get a shower, but so we just hung out there, and we always had oranges and bananas and stuff like that in the bus, so you could go get a little snack if you wanted to.
Okay.
Or, you know, people, we bought a lot of apples, and so we always had stuff on the bus going up and back. So there was always something to snack on, and like I said, we had beer and Gatorade and stuff like that. So everybody pretty much hung around until we could go get keys, and then somebody would always stay to wait for the last people, and the bus would come back around and pick them up and bring them over to wherever we were staying, whichever hotel.
Okay. And I didn't ask you this. Why would you want to spend another night there when, in theory, by 3 in the afternoon, everybody was back? You could get on the bus and go back to Phoenix.
You know, it's just the way we did it. That night, we would all go to the steakhouse.
Okay.
And so we'd be out there at the front of the building for the steakhouse. I think they opened then at 6 or 5 or something like that. But we'd be over there like half an hour ahead of time. So we were the first ones in the door.
Okay.
And we would all go in there. I don't think I was the only one at that time. Part of the time I was a vegetarian, so I didn't eat meat. But mm-hmm. The rest of them, all of them were going to have a hunk of steak. I mean, it's funny. This happened when backpacking, too, sometimes. You'd come out, and after living for a week on dehydrated stuff, all I wanted to do was go to McDonald's and have a big extra large fry and a Big Mac or whatever they had.
Right.
Just, I don't know why, you know, salty, fat, and
yeah,
and this get finishing this run kind of puts you in that same mood. You wanted, you know, a piece of meat, some salt, and fat, and so we would all gather at the steakhouse that's on the back of Bright Angel Lodge.
Yeah.
And queue up and get in there and have a big dinner. And then we'd go and sit over on the porch out in back of El Tabar.
Right.
And drink and howl at the moon. and then the next morning start to realize how sore we were going to be. But we weren't too bad yet. Lactic acid doesn't really start to hit you until the day after. So Monday was the worst day as far as pain.
Right.
So we would get on the bus and head back usually about 10 or so.
Okay.
After everybody had breakfast, you got a chance to stretch a little bit. And then when you get off the bus after getting back about 2 in the afternoon, you start to stiffen up. And by Monday morning, when it's time to go to work again, you were walking downstairs backwards and all kinds of
people would hobble in.
Hobble in to work. And people at work by then knew what we were doing, so they would laugh and point and stuff like that. So,
right. And did you make up T-shirts for that year?
Yes, we did.
Okay.
Yeah, we did T-shirts every year, I think, except the first one.
And what was the charge per person for that?
We're talking about 1989, right?
Yep.
Okay. I've got a few of the, let me see, 150, it was still 150 then. And sometimes I would ask when they got there for another 20 if I underestimated.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Might have been one of those years. Yeah.
$150, 2 nights lodging at the Rims, including transportation, and you know, get your own food. That's not bad. How easy was it to collect that $20 after the fact?
How hard was it?
Yeah.
Oh, it wasn't hard at all.
Okay.
I always, if anybody wanted to know where the money was at, I had no problem showing them where I spent the money. You know,
right, like, right.
This is where the money's going. And later on in, maybe 80, not 89 evidently, but 92 or so, I even sent them, when I sent them the note for the next year, because then we used snail mail, of course, I included, here's how I spent the money from last year.
Okay.
So they could see where the money went from the previous year.
Cool.
And if I increase it, you know, I would tell them, you know, I asked you for an extra $20 last year. So this year, send me $175 instead of $150. So
okay.
Kind of cover it.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's a good amount of change back then, 1989. So, yeah.
We never had a problem of running out other than once or twice I asked for another 20.
Okay.
Like I said, they just said, okay, no problem.
Yeah, good. And that's October. Okay. October 7th. So right. The North Rim hasn't closed yet, but it's getting pretty close.
Right.
And were there other runners going across then?
It started to get more and more. We found a group from Honeywell, which is a company that was based in Phoenix, or at least they had an operation in Phoenix. And we started seeing people from another group going over and started talking to them. And most of those people were walking. And they were actually doing it 2 days. They would go over, spend the night on the North Rim. And they were doing it the other way. They were coming across from Bright Angel, South Kaibab, to North Kaibab, up to the rim, spend the night, and then walk back the next day.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so I don't know what their times were, and I only met a couple of them, you know, on occasion, you know, we would cross paths. And then I met some of them later on when we started doing some of the other longer trail runs. I met a few of them that were part of that group off and on at different times. And there is a group still reminiscent of that that's still going. And I don't know if they're – I think it's mostly people out of the Moon Valley area. But I mentioned, I think, Rex Tanner – was one of the first ones to go with me. He is still doing rim to rim with those folks, and he's got over 50 rim to rims.
Wow. Okay.
And I'll check with him if you're interested at some point in time. Get in touch with him. I don't think he'd have a problem. He likes to talk.
Okay. So. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's kind of a character.
Okay. Cool.
And the other thing, we started seeing people doing doubles and double-double, but they were individual people. They weren't groups of people.
Okay.
And most of those, we got to know them because there'd be somebody on the rim. So we'd come out, and, you know, you stand around for a bit, and then somebody, what are you doing? Or, you know, we would talk to anybody. We had 3 hours, like you said, to kill.
Right.
In some cases. So we would talk to people and so they said, well, I'm here because my boyfriend's doing a rim to rim to rim.
Ah.
And we said, one day? And said, yeah. And then we know there was a group out of Tucson. And I think this was a guy, Young. I can't remember his first name anymore. But he used to run, he used to organize and put together these unofficial runs down here in Tucson, going the Mount, let me see, up Ovalde, up in the Santa Rita's, Mount Wrightston Massacre. And then you'd go to, from sun up to sundown, how many times could you go to the top and bottom? And
whoa!
And then he would, over in the Rincons, going up to Mica Mountain and some loop that ended up like 40 miles. You had to go over Mica Mountain, down the other side, then back up, and then back down.
Whoa!
It was like 40 miles, and he was... he started organizing not official, but timekeeping on rim to rim to rim. And it was after the North Rim had closed, so it was a couple of weeks after we ran, but I knew him from these other runs, and he had a bunch of tags that were had on it a special message that he changed every year so nobody could duplicate it. And he would had those on the North Rim, and you had to go get one of those, and you didn't know where it was at until he told you. So he was driving out there after the place had closed, but before the snow, and hiding these tags, and the person doing the rim to rim to rim, that would have to go over, find the tag, get back, and come back across. And unless you brought this tag back with you, he wasn't going to take your time. So he started that, and that was usually a week or 2 weeks after we did the rim to rim. But we found out about it because other people were doing rim to rim to rim all by themselves, or okay. unsupported, with, you know, just on the. And then one guy, one time, was doing a quad, so he was going back and forth twice. And like I said, that was kind of as you start, as this got on in years, we saw others, and then there was. And again, I would have to look up, I'll try and do some research on this and see if I can find it. But there was a magazine called Ultra Running, and they had an article in there about a group from San Francisco, or from San Diego, that advertised a rim-to-rim run. And somebody in the Park Service found out about it, and they did a sting on this guy. So they signed up a couple rangers, and then when they got to the North Rim and got to the trailhead to start the run, they stepped out and arrested him. And I don't know what the rest of the runners did at that point, but they arrested the organizers, took them to flag, and charged them with organizing an unorganized run or something.
Right, like that. Unsanctioned kind of event. Yeah.
Yeah. And they got fined and all this stuff.
Okay.
And this came out in the Ultra Runner. You know, they talked about it. And then they talked about how to avoid getting arrested, which we kind of did. You know, we never had any ceremony per se, you know, and the only year there were ever banners across the trailhead were the 1981 and 82, which were the Pro Advantage group out of Phoenix, and they got told they couldn't do that anymore as well. So after that, you know, we kind of kept it low-key. Even though we gave out the T-shirts, we never wore those T-shirts on the run or at the trailhead. Those T-shirts weren't handed out until on the bus on the way home.
Okay.
So nobody's running around with a T-shirt saying, I did a rim-to-rim.
Right.
You know, October, da-da-da-da. And so we more or less kept it low-key, and that worked up until 1995.
Okay, well, we're not there yet.
Let's
back up for a minute here. This fellow that was doing the runs out of Tucson, the Mount Wrightston Massacre and the Micah Mountain over and back.
Yeah.
What was his name again?
His last name is Young, and he has since passed away. But he was an engineer, of course, because I'll tell you the rest. He's a real fanatic on keeping detailed information on distances and time.
Oh, wow.
And he was kind of the unofficial timekeeper for ultra running for a number of years.
Okay.
He kept, you know, Western States 100 times, and he kept, when some of the other ones started developing in the Rockies, Leadville and that, he was the official recorder and maintainer of records. And he did likewise for the ones he organized down here in the Tucson area, kept all those records. And he started keeping records rim-to-rim times as well.
Oh, okay.
And then he started to organize this rim-to-rim-to-rim deal and, of course, kept the times for that. I just cannot remember his first name.
Okay.
But I looked him up once after, you know, I hadn't seen or heard from him for, you know, 10 or 15 years. I said, I wonder what... And it said that he passed away. But he did keep running. He did keep organizing these things and keep all these records and stuff. So I've always been curious if somebody took over those records.
Right. Where do they go?
In that database or not?
Huh.
I don't know.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. So that was 89. Seems like it went fairly well.
Yes, it did. Yeah.
Okay. And then what happened in 1990?
Okay, well, there was no more backpacking in the Grand Canyon until um, 2001. So the next few years, we transitioned. We started doing things like running chunks of theirs on the trail and doing a lot of longer trail runs and stuff like that. But we still continued to do the rib to rim. So 1990 on October 6th was the next rim to rim.
Okay. How many people were in that one?
1990,
October 6th. Okay.
Yep. About 24.
Okay. Did you still use a big bus or did you downsize?
No, we still use a big bus that year.
And picked up Ted and Flagstaff and drove over to the North Rim for the night?
Yep.
Okay.
And the fastest that year, this is 1990. Let's see what Terry did that year, because they're usually the two. Yeah, Terry Moore was faster that year. He was a 440. And Dick Lane was a 448.
Okay.
And then we had a couple others that were real close right behind that. Rex, who I mentioned had done the 50 of them, he did a 453.
And then yeah, 5 minutes behind. That's not far.
Yeah. And then he, Don Holly, who was out of California and was a friend of Dick's, did a 454. So he wasn't far behind either.
Yeah. Oh, okay. And what was your slowest that year?
That slowest that year, and again, that's 1990, was 8:23, and again, it was Larry Brown.
Okay. Well, Larry's having a good time. He's consistent.
Yeah. He just wanted to go and do it.
Good for him. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. That's a good time still for walking.
One more or two more times.
Okay.
And what I have for records right now, I didn't. Unfortunately, I don't have records beyond 92, and there was we did 93, 94, and 5, and 96.
Okay.
But somewhere I've lost all that.
And no injuries, no difficulties that way?
No. 1990, I had a stress fracture in the right shin just below the knee, so I was going to look and see what mine ended up doing. Probably not too good. 6:15. So I was almost an hour slower than the year before.
Okay. And possibly in some pain with that?
Yeah, but you know, ibuprofen to do wonders.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we did a lot of things. Now that was right around that time was the time I came up and I threw up when I got to the trailhead to the top. And I have trouble because I'd log it that way, so I don't remember exactly, but it was like 1990. In the 80s, they started experimenting with these rehydration mixes and powders and all that.
Right.
And there was a study being done at, I think it's UCLA, and they were compounding these different things to give to people who are participating in ultra events. And you mix it with water and you drink it every so many hours, and during competition it's supposed to put electrolytes back in and some carbohydrates and things keep going. And so this is a write-up, and it was in ultra running again, so I sent them a letter. I said, hey, you know, I'm going to do this run rim to rim in Grand Canyon, and you know, I'd really like to try some of this stuff. Can I get some? And they said, sure, we'll send you some. So they sent me a batch of this stuff. And it came in like a coffee can. And just had the plastic top tape on the top, so it wasn't sealed real well or anything. And so I mixed them up. Then I used it as we were running around and training and stuff. And so when it came to that time, I mixed them up. And, of course, I told some of the other people about that, and they were all, okay, so maybe we need to try some. Well, I took off along with everybody else, and I got to Indian Garden, and somebody was at Indian Garden, and he said, here, why don't you have a couple pieces of an orange? And I thought, okay, why not? So I popped a couple of those oranges in. Well, that must have thrown off the balance of all these things that I'd been drinking, because by the time I got close to the top, I was really nauseated, and I literally walked out, walked over to the corral and threw up in the corral over there. And then, of course, everybody's laughing and carrying on, and thought it was pretty good that I had tried this super stuff and then I'm throwing up. I kept telling them it was the oranges, not the stuff. And but I wrote them a letter back and said, this is what I did. They never answered back about, you know, well, we didn't tell you, dummy, don't eat or drink anything else. But that was just my theory as to what happened. Not that the stuff was bad. It was that I should never have taken those oranges and upset the chemical balance in my stomach. So.
Yeah, it's a fine balance there.
It is. And it's, as we got to running longer and stuff like that, we, you know, other things started coming out. You know, you started seeing some of the first energy bars and some of that stuff in the late 80s, early 90s. And so, of course, you're going to try some of that stuff to see if it works.
Yeah.
And then the powders and the mixes and things like that and the stuff to rehydrate with afterwards. And then there was this big thing where you should be using proteins or carbohydrates. And a lot of that's even more so even now. There's a lot of contention that the stuff I read that you need carbs beforehand and you need protein afterwards. And then people say, no, you got to build yourself back up. Anyway, it's still not a settled science in that respect.
Yeah. Interesting. All right, so that was 1990.
Yeah, and October 5th of 91, did another MBRM. And in 91, had 21 people.
Okay, so 30 to 24 to 21, you have any idea why the numbers are decreasing? Were you not actively, you know, work going out to try to bring people in, or what do you think was a slow decline in numbers?
Yeah, I never actively recruited ever.
Okay.
A lot of the people would do one time and they said, boy, that was great. I'm glad I did that, but no, I'm not coming back.
Got it.
And so, and some of it was a matter of could they get, you know, off at that time.
Because right.
That particular time. So I was looking at some of these names on here. That only a lot of those only did it one time. So they might have been part of one of the bigger years, and then that was it. But 92 was, on the other hand, was the most people.
Oh.
So,
okay.
As far as the actual number of people that participated.
All right. And again, with a big bus on this one?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And what were the times?
Let's see. Fastest time was Dick Lane again at 4:27. Oh, I'm sorry. There was another guy. This was an interloper that only ran 2 years. He was Rudy Thiel, T-H-I-E-L. He ran at 4:25, and Dick Lane was right behind him at 4:27.
How do you spell Rudy's last name again?
T-H-I-E-L.
Thank you. He was 4:24?
He was 4:25.
4:25. And what was Dick then?
4:27.
Okay. Wow. Right on each other's heels.
Yeah. And that year, Larry Brown was back, and he actually improved the sign significantly. He was back to a 7:49.
Okay.
So he got his time back up a little bit.
And what were you doing?
And let me see. We're talking 91, right?
Yep.
Yep. 523.
Okay. So you're consistent.
Yep.
You're actually better than you were the year before with a stress factor by an hour almost.
Yeah. And I'd done a 537 2 years before, so I was back down below that.
That's right.
I've done pretty well in that regard.
Yeah. Any females in this run?
Not till 1992. We had our first female.
Okay. Why do you think that was?
It was kind of a... At that time, I don't know that there were a lot of women that were running longer ultra-type runs was part of it. And just... Although we knew some of the women in the Phoenix area that ran longer runs, they didn't seem to be interested in doing this. And it may have been because just the idea of being with 30 guys in a bus didn't seem like a good idea.
Yeah.
And I can't particularly blame them for that, but that I don't know for certain. I never had anybody say, I'm not getting on the bus with you bunch.
Right.
So, but it was kind of a old boys club, if you will. I mean, there was lots of joking and carrying on and other, you know, things and giving each other a hard time about stuff. And I think did I say about the gentleman who had kidney cancer and lost a kidney, and then we gave him a stone he had to carry to make up for the
weight? Yeah, right.
Yeah. Okay. So we were kind of crude in some regard. So, and that might have been part of it. But we never actively recruited anybody, but it wasn't because I didn't think they could do it. It was just didn't seem, I never actively recruited anybody for this from day one. Let me put it that way.
Right.
When we first started it, they said, let's do this. And they kind of, well, who's going to organize this? I said, okay, well, I'll organize it.
Right.
And after that, it just kind of grew on its own. There's not a single person that I went to and said, hey, why don't you go with us, except for CL. And CL, as I mentioned, he, for a long time, he was a runner, but he never ran more than a 10K, once in a while a 10-miler. And I think it just intrigued him enough that he decided he would try this. But that wasn't for a few years. So his first time running was 1987. So we had run, three or four before that, and he didn't participate in those, even though we had been backpacking together.
So it sounds like you were a good organizer, but you were not a promoter.
Right.
Got it.
Right.
Good. Okay.
Yeah, well, I didn't, and maybe it's back to that subject we talked about a little bit, where promoting might put you in a position that you don't want to be in.
Right.
Whereas if somebody says they want to go along, you say, yeah, you think you can do it, go ahead and go along.
Right.
But there was always the warning to everybody that was new, and I sent, along with some of the information, I sent the notes that went out each year were basically telling people, here's how much it costs, here's where we're going to do it, or the days we're going to do it, here's the schedule, and here's the other things, which are basically, there's no aid, no support, no insurance, no porta-potties, no medals, no whining, no pity, and if you don't show up, tough. We're going to spend your money.
Right.
So it was pretty black and white that, if you go, that's fine, but nobody's going to take care of you.
Right.
You're on your own. And everybody, at least to my knowledge, there was only one guy that, sometimes I don't know if I should reflect on these things or not, but anyway, he came along as a friend of somebody else. And I told him, I told everybody, be at the bus at 6:15 with your luggage ready to go. And this guy comes walking up like 6:18 or 6:19.
Oops.
And I just ripped into him because I always thought it was important to be on time. And that here's a bus load of people waiting for this one guy.
Right.
And he later told somebody, he said, nobody's ever swore at me or yelled at me like that in my whole life. And I felt bad a little bit about it. On the other hand, I thought, well, maybe he learned something from that. But in any case, it was, I was uptight about these things getting going, and so I can't say I was relaxed about it, but I was pretty uptight about getting this thing going and getting everybody off safely on their way and making sure everybody made it out the other side. And if somebody had been hurt, I certainly would have, you know, alerted the Park Service and got them help. It wasn't, but I didn't want people to rely on that being the fact, or that I recruited them to do this and something happened.
Right.
And I think that was part of my, if you want to come along, you know what it is, that's up to you.
It's funny, Charlie, because when I think about this, yeah, it takes an organizer, but everybody else gets to just follow directions and run along more or less. But one person has to sweat it out, and that's the organizer, to make sure that the bus is there and the people have their rooms available. And you know, you do have a train that will leave a station. And so, you know, you tell people, look, the train's going to leave the station at blah, blah. And if you don't show up, that train's going to be gone. So yeah, you know, people don't realize the strain that you're under to organize such an event.
And of course, this person never came back again either. But it's just, your life experiences, different people have different experiences. I spent almost 7 years in the Air Force, and you know, you go through basic training, and then I went through OTS again to become an officer. And those experiences are ones where there's a good guy, bad guy type strategy, where one guy really screams and yells at you, and the other one does, you know, you don't want to get him upset, so let's do this right and do this right, you know, the first time and stuff like that.
Right.
Kind of playing this game. But through that experience, you learn a lot of new words. So some of those I managed to dredge up that day and that occasion, and I guess...
the drill sergeant and you stepped out.
It did. So it was just one of those incidents, and I'm glad it only happened one time. So. And the rest of the people that knew me just laughed it off, because they knew me well enough to know that, you know, it wasn't anything serious. It was just that I was upset he was so darn late. So.
Yeah, and everybody else was waiting too, so they're all twiddling their thumbs,
because
you said to be there, and they were there. Yeah.
Yeah. You gotta, with a bunch of guys like this, you gotta run a pretty tight ship, because otherwise they'll walk all over you, and you know.
Well, they'll wander off, and you'll never get back to Phoenix in a decent time. And you know, I mean, you do have to keep people around and aligned, and
yeah.
Give them a schedule. Here's a schedule. Deal with it. Yeah. Well, do we have time to go through 1992?
Sure, if you want to, I'll touch on that. This is the first one. This is the first and only time we had a woman join us. Her name was Jennifer Henderson. And at the time, she was born in 58, and this was 92. So she was about 34. Yeah.
Okay.
34 years old. And she ran it in 4:39.
Whoa.
Everybody's butt. Nobody beat her.
Wow.
And she was a friend of Dick's, and he had met her through, she was an ultra runner.
Okay.
And had done quite a bit of running. And so her and her husband came along as well. He didn't do anywhere near as good as she did. He did a 5:34, so he was a good hour or close to an hour behind her.
Okay.
And he was a couple years older than she was. No, he was one that he was born in 42, so he was 50 years old at that time. But she was rather tall and thin, and I guess that must have really helped her. I don't know. I'm speculating. Anyway, she just took off and chewed right through the canyon, right out the other side.
Wow, good for her.
Yeah. No, it was very impressive, and I was kind of happy that happened, and hoping maybe somebody else, but she didn't come back again, and we never had another woman except for that time.
Huh.
And
how many people were on the 92 run?
Now, this was one of the bigger ones, so this one had 32 people.
Okay.
So it jumped back up again, and the slowest one on that one was Dick Blue, and he was 11 hours and 30 minutes.
Ooh.
Now, he had kind of a, this was like his fifth time, and the first time he was 10 hours and 17, but then he got down to 7:35, and then all of a sudden he went back up to 11:30. So I don't remember. He may have been injured. We do talk to him, my wife and I keep in touch with him because he used to work with her and me.
Okay.
And he's been back to the canyon to do, he did a rim-to-rim one time, 10 years ago, and he actually walked out a fireman from Phoenix who had underestimated how difficult it was, so Dick walked him out.
Huh.
So it had to be fairly late in the day. And then the last time he did it, he got to Cottonwood, and he called the rangers from Cottonwood, and they told him how to get into the cabin to get some gear, so he slept there and then walked out the next day.
Hmm.
And I didn't know they did that, but he explained it all to us how they did.
Oh, that's good. That's a nice way to do it. You just stay there and go out the next day. It's fine.
Yep.
Yeah. 32 people. Okay. That's just.
I don't think too many people know that because that become a thing.
Anyway. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all about how to fluff you up again. Not you, but, you know, how to fluff people up to get them to calm down and heal up a little bit, and they'll get out, but it just take a little longer than you were thinking.
Yep.
So, yeah. What was your time in 92?
92:33.
Okay. So you're running good.
Still doing under 6 hours because I always felt good if I could do it under six.
Yeah, no kidding. Good deal. And any other interesting things that happened on the 92 trip that you remember?
Other than Jennifer, I don't remember anything else. That was pretty much it.
Okay. All right, well, maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this interview series. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. That'll work.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, this will conclude part 8 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charlie Schultz. Today is Friday, April 14th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Charlie, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.